More Posthumous Adventures. It's now May of 2017. It's been more than 10 years since I released the original version of The Heroin Diaries. I always say that writing The Heroin Diaries saved me, or rather, publishing it did. I'm not sure that when I was scribbling those journal entries in 1987, they were doing too much for me. Showing them to the world 20 years later, that's a different matter entirely. Because looking back at those diaries, some of them focused and lucid, some spaced out, some plain insane, was a shock. Reading the minutes of the madness reminded me that my life was so abject back then that it was almost a relief when I died. I suppose the book helped me be accountable to myself and to the public. It was also the best incentive imaginable never to relapse into drugs again. And I haven't. It's something I'm proud of, and I'm also humble about. I've stayed clean. I've stayed sober, stayed with the program. But I know I can never get complacent, because I will be in recovery until the day I die again. So let me try to bring you up to date with my posthumous adventures since I put out The Heroin Diaries. I hope you're not hoping for more of the same sex, drugs, and rock and roll debauchery. If you are, well, I'm glad that you're going to be disappointed. I mean, come on, right? You had a year's worth of my misery. Now let me tell you about the 10 years of joy and positives. I try not to boast, but I've earned it, and so can you. I'm probably happier now than I've ever been in my life. I'm sober, content in my skin, married and in love, a family man, a businessman, and every day, from the moment I wake up, I'm constantly engrossed in creativity. I believe you need to feed your obsession. You need to chase it, track it down, and embrace it. Mine is creativity. Have you found yours yet? The first thing I do every morning is pick up my guitar, start playing and writing, and then I go do my radio show, Sixth Sense. Or I hit the streets to do some photography. Right now I'm working on another book and my first photo exhibit. I don't wake up thinking how to score drugs today, and yet I'm as creative as ever. This is such a relief. I sometimes hear people say, "Oh, I was more creative when I drank and did drugs." And I used to believe that. Now I think it's bullshit. You don't need drugs to be creative. You should be able to tap into it in sobriety, and it should be a clear vision. What I've learned is clarity is one of the most important things we can learn and teach ourselves in life. Yes, it can be learned. When I read my old diary entries again, they show just how blatantly I ran towards the destruction needle. I thought living like that was glamorous because the artists I loved did it, and they were extremely creative and cool. What a mistake that was. The kind of mistake that ends up killing you. The 10 years since The Heroin Diaries have not been all sweetness and light. There's been a lot of self-improvement, a lot of laughter, a lot of love, but it's also had its challenges, like every life has. In my opinion, it's how we handle the darkness that really allows us to bask in the sunshine. Life is not all roses. It's hard, and the struggle gives us values and grit. The big difference is that I have faced the challenges sober, with my sights set on staying in the moment and being honest. In the midst of all the media that was happening when The Heroin Diaries came out in 2007, I was also getting divorced. It was brutal and bruising, and I had to fight tooth and nail to keep what was rightfully mine. My family came first, even when I was in the line of fire. What's always saved me when life gets shitty and I find my back firmly against a wall is throwing myself into being creative. So I kept myself together by writing more, getting deeper and deeper into my photography, and always my number one, playing more music. Yet doing this alone would be a vacant life. I'm proud to be a father of four beautifully different and original human beings. My kids kick ass, let me tell you. My only real regret is I've had to spend so much time on the road during their lives. I hope it gave them some form of strength and resilience. I hope it showed them how to love and feel love when things aren't conventional. The Six family is anything but conventional, but what beautiful and strong souls they are. Specifically, when the Heroin Diaries first came out, I was playing more music with my side project, 6AM. Once we decided to make the Heroin Diaries soundtrack into a full album and form a band, the music came so quickly to us. James and DJ were amazing songwriting partners, and we all contributed melodies and lyrics. They got it. We had a real connection. We all agreed on three things. If it's fun, we'll keep doing it. It has to be honest, and we have to raise the bar. I think going into life with an attitude of gratitude is key, but whatever you do, also be an overachiever. Trust me, it works. When we made the Heroin Diaries soundtrack, we talked about connecting the music and lyrics, which had to stand on their own, to the book. We introduced narration, me reading some of my old diary entries over the songs. It was exciting because in a weird way, it felt like we were doing something that nobody had done before. 6AM snowballed incredibly quickly. We made a video for Life is Beautiful, put it out, and it went to number 2 on the Hot Mainstream Rock chart. People were really getting what we were trying to do. The feeling between the three of us was amazing. It wasn't so good in Motley Crue when we went back into the studio to record a new album, Saints of Los Angeles, the one that would turn out to be our last. If I'm honest, by now, Vince, Tommy, Mick, and I were not really on the same page. We just couldn't get along. I think maybe we stopped having the same vision of what Motley Crue should be. We had always been open-minded. We were experimenting with sequencers and weird sounds as far back as the 80s. But I always thought Motley Crue should be Motley Crue. We shouldn't steer so far off the road that fans go, "I don't understand this." As the saying goes, stay in your lane, but race like hell. We were heading out on our usual enormous world tour. This one was called Crue Fest, and it was 45 to 50 shows. A few months before this massive tour started, the promoters called up our management. "The hottest band out there is 6AM, one promoter said. They could pull 5 to 7,000 people early in the day, every day. We want them on the bill. Uh-oh. I wasn't sure if the Motley guys would go for that, but I called them up one by one. I said, "Look, the upside is the house will be full before we even go on. There are two other bands between the sets, and I won't be the same performer in 6AM as I am in Motley Crue. I'll really take a back seat when we play." The guys listened, and they were super cool with it. I appreciated that, because they didn't have to be. I love that Crue Fest tour. I hit the stage with 6AM in the afternoon, would hang out at the venue for a few hours, then rock out with Motley Crue. It was great to play with two different bands, two different styles, two different tunings, two different sets of music. If life is about new experiences, then that was life out loud. It all felt creative and positive, and around this time, another amazing project came along for me. Alan Kovac, my manager, got the idea from listening to my narrations on the Heroin Diaries soundtrack album that I would be great at having my own radio show. I've always been obsessed with radio, ever since I was a boy. When I was really little, I would just listen to it and think, where are these voices coming from? Then as I got older, it became the place I got my steady flow of new music. I would sit in Idaho in my grandmother's orange Datsun 510 station wagon with my fake Les Paul trying to learn the chords for most of the popular songs on the radio. That was the beginning of learning to write my own songs. Because I wasn't fast enough at learning other people's songs, so I'd piece 3 or so ideas together, and voila, I'm a songwriter. So Alan set up a meeting with Premier Radio, and I headed to Chicago for our first, and definitely not our last, meeting. I told them, "When I'm on tour and I tune into the local radio, wherever I am, I hear the bands that I love, yes, but when I hear the DJ talking, I sometimes tune out. What if we did a syndicated show? We can deliver you a turnkey show covering multiple formats. I love the classic rock that I grew up on, but I'm a big fan of alternative and the harder side of active rock. If we can cover all the formats and let me play new music, we can enrich radio. I firmly believe it needed a facelift." They loved the idea, and I started doing my Sixth Sense show. I loved it from the get-go. I took to it so well, little did I know, we'd still be doing it 8 years later. We're now the biggest syndicated rock radio show in the world. You can't do that if you're strung out on drugs. Being able to share my love of music every single day, I actually can't believe they pay me to do that. Having done thousands of interviews over the years, it was exciting to be on the other side of the mic and have my turn at asking the questions. Maybe because I'm an artist, I know how to talk to other artists about what their music means to them. Some of the interviews I've done have blown my mind. Paul McCartney came in. I was kind of nervous beforehand because I really wanted to do a great job. But then he walked in, he sat down, looked at me and said, "I know you've done a lot of stuff and your radio show reaches millions of people, so thank you for having me on." Kind of peed my pants a little right then. He told me about how much he's always loved radio and how much it still influences him, even today. Those words explain why he's still one of the greatest artists alive, because he loves music. Mike Tyson was fantastic. He was totally raw. He has the biggest heart. Mike is fragile and strong at the same time. He knows what he wants, but he doesn't always know how to get there, and he's honest about that. Before he came in to do the radio show, his people told me, "Mike will take pictures with you, but whatever you do, don't ask him to pretend to bite your ear. He is kind of sensitive about that." I said, "Sure, fuck. I don't want to piss off Mike Tyson." Interview was great. Afterwards, we did a photo together. I didn't really look at the photo until after he left, but there he was, standing by me, with his mouth open, pretending to bite my ear. Mike gave me his phone number because he's also a recovering addict, and occasionally, I'll call and check up on him. I ask, "How you doing?" And he'll always say the same thing. "I'm fine. I'm still sober." When you're in recovery, that's the conversation that you have. It's the conversation of life. It's living in the moment. Life is cool. Imagine trying to do all that if I was still on drugs. So with Motley Crue, 6 a.m., my radio show, and my love of photography, my creative career was going along just fine. My personal life, not so much. After my divorce, I dated on and off, but I was way more concerned with being around for my kids and trying to make sure I was home for them, which too often in their lives I hadn't been. I was very wary of introducing a new girl ever to them. I didn't want them to be hurt if it didn't work out. They'd been through too much already. In any case, nobody I went out with was up to a standard I wanted in my life. That was before I met Courtney Bingham. It started via a friend in New York. I was talking to him on the phone one day about my single life, and he said, "I know this girl who is very lovely and very social and has tons of friends, and I think you guys would probably get along. I could introduce you to her. She lives out in LA, and she might introduce you to some girls." I said, "Yeah, sure. I mean, what do I got to lose?" My friend called Courtney and told her, "I've got this friend who lives in Calabasas. He's got 4 kids. He works a lot. You might like him. He's funny in a smart-ass kind of way." Courtney agreed to talk to me, but I guess she was thinking, "Wow, some poor old bald guy living out in Calabasas who can't get a date." In fact, she even asked, "Can he not get a date or something?" "Oh, he can get a date," he told her, truthfully. "He just doesn't want to date strippers and crazy women anymore." In the meantime, I looked Courtney up online, found out that she was a model. I looked through her photographs. Now, in my experience, this can be a recipe for disaster, but I really do need to get out more. What I thought was this: if she's going to be my wingman to take me out and introduce me to other women, what are the women she introduces me to going to look like? Because she is beautiful. Courtney and I talked on the phone, and we really hit it off. She was a cool chick. Very soft heart, high morals, extremely creative. Uh-oh. We decided to get together for dinner. She told me what kind of car she had, so I saw her as she pulled up as I waited for her outside of the Italian restaurant. When she got out of the car, I thought, again, uh-oh. This is not my wingman. This is my date. Of course, she didn't know all this, and I was probably just jumping the gun. But I didn't see why that should stop me. We sat down, told the waiter what we wanted, and at the same time I asked him, can we get the check? As I did so, I saw Courtney look at me with open-mouthed surprise. I thought, yes, I suppose that might seem weird to some people. The thing is, that is what I've always done, get the check when I order. As far as I'm concerned, eating is something you try to finish as quickly as possible. I'm used to being on the road, throwing down food backstage or eating in truck stops. I like to eat and go get it over with. I always figured that I could be doing something much more interesting than sitting and eating. For me, eating and sleeping are the two biggest wastes of time. Soon became clear that Courtney didn't see things the same way. By the time our check came, I was already done eating, but Courtney had hardly started. She'd have a bite of food, chew it slowly, then put her fork down and talk. Another slow bite of food, more talk. We had the longest dinner ever. But no complaints for me. We were having a blast. We laughed a lot, and it was so inspiring to see someone with so much drive. I can't remember if I'd ever felt a connection quite like this. And this was also new for me because I was sober and really knew what I wanted and didn't want in my life anymore. I'd come to believe that an act of God would need to happen for me to meet a woman who measured up to my standards. Normally, a drawn-out meal like that would be torture for me, but I was having a fantastic time. I couldn't help but notice, though, that Courtney kept staring at my face and my hair. Oh, I have a star tattooed on my face, I suddenly blurted out. Is it freaking you out? I forget it's there sometimes. No, she said. You have such a cool style. Oh, good, I told her. I thought you were thinking I might be a serial killer. Courtney and I got along so good that we started hanging out, and it soon progressed to dating. It all felt so natural. We have an age difference, but it never felt like any kind of a problem. She's an old soul, and I guess I'm still kind of a super young spirit. I guess it's too late to try on the conventional suit for me anyway. Live and let live, I say. After all, I'm alive. We were having the best time, but even so, I wasn't sure when to introduce Courtney to my children. That is always a hard decision for any parent in that situation, but sometimes the only way to do it is to do it. So after we've been dating a month, Courtney dropped me off at home one night and I said, do you want to come in? She did. My youngest daughter, Frankie, was there, and the two of them hit it off as soon as they set eyes on each other. In fact, after about a half an hour, Frankie asked her, do you want to stay the night? Hey, you're 10 years old, I told her, laughing. You don't get to decide that. But what a cool question, right? Courtney did blurt out that she could sleep on the couch. Man, it's not the 80s anymore. Suddenly, life all seemed to be going in the right way. I put out a book of words and photos, This Is Gonna Hurt, and 6 a.m. made an album of the same name to go with it. The book signings were emotional again. The subject matter was bullying. And it was before the anti-bullying campaigns that happened all around the world. The conversation was about being different and embracing that. 6 a.m. had a U.S. mainstream rock number one hit with the song Lies of the Beautiful People, which tackled the same subject perfectly. The sleeve image of a girl and a snake was the first time I had ever had my photography published, another milestone. Meanwhile, Motley Crue went out on a world tour on Ozfest, and then we did the same on a bunch of dates with Kiss. It was around this time, during the latter tour, that we decided to bring the band to an end. I called a band meeting when we were in Tokyo and just said what was on my mind, and had been for a while. I have this idea, I said. We're not getting any younger. We're doing great, but wouldn't it be amazing to do one final tour and end on a high with huge shows in Los Angeles? The fantastic thing is, everybody agreed. We were all on the same page. Had we still been super juiced and wanting to make the same kind of music, it might have been a different story, but we weren't, not anymore. We all liked the idea of saying, that's it, and putting a big definitive period on the band's history. That's why we got a cessation of touring agreement drawn up, meaning none of us could go out as Motley Crue ever again. We all hated the idea of a few years down the line, somebody deciding, I want to make a comeback, and the other guy's not wanting to do it. I didn't want us to end up suing each other's asses or two Motley Crues to be trundling around the nostalgia circuit. You know how many lame-ass bands are touring with just one or two band members left? No, that wasn't for us. So now we had to psych up for the last 18-month round-the-world final tour. But before we did that, I had some more important business. I wanted to propose to Courtney. I knew I wanted to do it in style, and I had been racking my brains over the best way to do it. And I was already equipped. I'd bought a diamond, had it set 6 months earlier, and it had been hidden in a box in my sock drawer in my closet ever since. Then the opportunity presented itself. A UK magazine, Classic Rock, wanted to give me its Showman of the Year award at a ceremony in London, and we decided that I would fly over and present my radio program from the awards. Perfect. I would fly to London. On my way back, I would stop off in St. Bart's, meet Courtney for a vacation, and I could propose there. The best laid plans and all that. My master plan got off to a pretty shitty start when I set off for LAX for my flight to London. I was halfway to the airport when I suddenly realized I'd forgotten the diamond. It was still in my sock drawer. I had to turn around, drive back home, and then make record time on the freeway just to catch my flight. I stashed the diamond in my backpack that I always have with me, along with my cameras and my computer. The Classic Rock Awards were a really cool hang. I was interviewing Jeff Beck and loads of other guys on my radio show at the venue before the ceremony. It was great to get the award, even though I'm not too good at receiving compliments or awards in public. After the London Awards, we were packing away my radio show and chatting when my producer suddenly asked me, hey, have you got your backpack? Because I saw one just like yours lying in the other room. Fuck! How hard am I trying to lose that diamond? I got back to my hotel at 2 in the morning, got no sleep before I flew to St. Bart's the next day to meet Courtney. At least I had the ring with me. St. Bart's is all hills and single roads, so Courtney and I rented a Jeep. The island is very French, with secret beaches and little hideaway restaurants everywhere, and we just relaxed in the sun, and I worked out my plan. Courtney tends to be the more responsible of the two of us, so she'll usually organize stuff, do the driving, and plan where we're going to eat. Yep, I've been trained to enjoy long meals now. So she was surprised when I told her, hey, on Friday, I have a surprise for you. I'm going to take you out to dinner. Okay, she said, where do you want to go? Don't worry about it, I told her. I got it. You don't even know how to find a restaurant. Don't worry about it. I got it. I might even surprise you and do a good job. Friday rolled around, and we went down to the hotel lobby and out to the Jeep. Courtney looked beautiful as always. As she walked around to the driver's seat, I intercepted her. Give me the keys, I said. Huh? You're going to drive? Yeah, it's a special night, I told her. But before we go, let's go into the hotel and get you a glass of wine. Yes, you can be sober around people who drink. In the hotel, some staff came over and said, hi, Nikki. Everybody was smiling at us, and Courtney looked confused. Why is everyone looking at us so weird? She whispered. I don't know, I said, even though I did. Follow me, please, Mr. Six, said the head waiter, and led the way out of the back of the restaurant towards the beach. Courtney and I walked hand in hand along the sand, through a trail of lanterns leading to a tent overlooking the ocean. We got into the tent. It was a giant arbor of thousands and thousands of red and yellow roses I'd flown in from another island. I can't believe you did all this, she told me. I thought to myself, you ain't seen anything yet. We sat talking as Courtney sipped her wine and I drank my water. I kept trying to nod to an over-attentive waiter to get the hell out of there, but it took him a few minutes to get the hint. Courtney was talking and talking and talking, and then I got down on one knee. What are you... she asked. and then she was dead silent. I opened the box with the rock in it that I had almost lost multiple times, and I asked her if she would marry me. I told her before that I would never get married again. Now here I was proposing. She started crying. I'd been down there for a while. My knee was actually beginning to hurt. "Is this a yes or a no?" I asked her. "I need to get off my knee." And she started laughing and she said yes. We got married in the Greystone Mansion in Beverly Hills. It was a beautiful day. We kept it small. My kids, extended family, maybe 90 people that we've known for years and years. I've been through some serious ups and downs in my life, but I don't think I've ever been happier than that glorious California day. I had my bride, my wonderful kids, and my friends. What more can a man ask for? I'll call it my second chance. I won't fuck this up. I've learned that creativity comes in many forms. When I published The Heroin Diaries 10 years ago, I was getting deeper and deeper into photography. A decade on, it's a full-on love affair. A few years ago, I built a small studio called Funny Farm. I shot so many amazing sessions there, especially as they were with people whom wider society wouldn't normally consider beautiful. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and you can find it in the most unexpected places. You can find it in my photographs. The people I shoot are the story. I just give them a chance to tell it. I began reaching out to burn victims, people born with different diseases, amputees, transgenders. I would ask them if they would do me the honor of letting me photograph them, and I explained how I worked. I would tell them, "I'll build a set and a story, and I'll put you in it. It will be a super creative adventure. Are you up for it?" They nearly always were. I'll never forget a girl named Farah who I photographed for This Is Gonna Hurt. She was a prostitute who weighed about 350 pounds. I found her through a website for guys who are attracted to big girls, and I asked if she would do some modeling for me. Farah's black, and the first thing that we did when she came to Funny Farm, we painted her skin white and added deep veins all over her body. We made her a wig and did her face up to look like Diana Ross. She looks so pretty and different is always good. We sat and talked for a long time. Often, I will talk to people I'm photographing for up to 2 hours before I so much as pick up my camera. We'll just hang out and chat, and they tell me their stories. I seem to have a gift. People want to tell me their deepest, darkest secrets. I've been getting fan mail since the early 80s with people pouring out their hearts and stories to me. Farah had a really hard life. Her mother and father both died from heroin overdoses, and her stepfather had put her out for prostitution when she was very young. It was hard, a horrible story. Plus, she had an extreme weight problem to deal with. I put Farah on a platform like a pedestal that I'd built for her. She stood there completely naked, and I told her, "Let your hands fall. Just be okay with where you're at." "Okay, Nikki," she said. She trusted me. That means the world to me. Honesty and trust. We gave her some gel. It was the same liquid that they put into McDonald's milkshakes before they add the color and the sweetener and put it in the refrigerator. It was completely clear, and I asked Farah to put some in her mouth. "I want you to shut your eyes," I told her, "and when you're ready, I want you to let out all that pain of your childhood, all that pain, all that misery, all that remorse, all those regrets. Let it out and let me get it on camera. Make it your purging." "Yes," she said, "I want to do this." She took the liquid into her mouth. "Are you ready?" I asked. She nodded. I held down the shutter and Farah just let it all out. She gave a scream and vomited this clear liquid all over her naked body, her beautiful face. It was amazing. She started crying. "Thank you," she said. "This is one of the greatest days of my life." "Thank you," I replied. "You gave me a great story, and I'm grateful." It had been so moving, and the best was yet to come. Months later, we made a documentary of the This Is Gonna Hurt sessions, and I brought in different people who I'd photographed to talk about their experiences. To my delight, Fair agreed to come back. When she walked in, she looked wonderful. She was wearing a beautiful dress. She had lost a lot of weight. She had these really cool, funky glasses on. Her hair was all done up. She just looked spectacular. "Wow, look at you," I said as I hugged her. Fair sat down. We put the camera on her, and she started talking. "I've quit prostitution," she said. "I've re-enrolled in college. I'm studying art." She just looked, well, she was so happy. I'd captured her very worst moment, and she looked at it and thought, "I don't ever want to be her again." That is the magic of photography. It's kind of like recovering from drugs and alcohol. It's the recovery that is the beautiful part of the story. And we can all have this be our story. People don't realize how beautiful it is to come out on the other side of heroin, cocaine, or alcohol addiction. But it can be done. Believe me, it can be done. Pretty soon, though, I had to let Funny Farm go because I knew I was going to be away for a very long time on the Motley Crue final tour, and I would not be able to be there. Okay, it was time for us to put a stake through the heart of Motley Crue. When we hit the stage, we still kicked and snarled our way through Home Sweet Home, Kickstart My Heart, Wild Side, Dr. Feelgood. We still had it. The magic was still there for the last time. Felt so great to go out on top. It was the four of us who had started it, and the four of us ending it together. Now that's honesty and rock and roll. We did what we wanted to do. We went out on our own terms. Now, it was a seriously long tour. And as 2015 ground on with no end to the dates in sight, my poor punished body was giving me a hard time. I was having serious problems with my shoulders from breaking guitars forever. And my left hip was slowly grinding away from jumping off the top of amps and from the style of playing I've developed as a kid. My left leg always kicked out. Add to that a bass guitar and 35 years of being a lunatic on stage, well, I was in pain. But you know what? So what? I love rock and roll. In any case, I relieved the pressure by taking every chance I could to run back into the arms of an old lover, photography. Although I no longer had Funny Farm, I wasn't about to lay down my cameras. I decided to lean more to another huge passion of mine, which is street photography. As I traveled the world, I decided that I would put myself into situations that most people would consider not safe. I would go to the back alleys with my cameras and just sit down and start talking to people. What could possibly go wrong, right? Actually, nothing did. Instead, I met some truly amazing people and took some photographs I'm incredibly proud of. And I had amazing experiences that I will never forget, like meeting Roseanne. One morning, somewhere in Canada, I was walking the streets in a Skid Row area. It was raining, and I passed two old buildings right next to each other that had been fenced off. Their windows had all been busted in, and people had thrown loads of crap and furniture between them. There was a shelter in there. I heard something rustling, and I saw something move on the ground. When I went to the fence and I looked in, a woman recoiled from me. She was maybe 30. I looked at her, and she looked at me. "Hi, I'm Nikki. I'm a recovering heroin addict," I told her. "I do street photography. I'm just out here telling everybody's story because maybe it will help somebody else." "Hi, Nikki," she said. "Do you want to talk a little bit if I just sit down here?" I asked. She did. She sat on the ground on her side of the fence, and I sat on my side for maybe 2 hours. She had a hospital band on her wrist and scars beneath it, but she was trying to present herself nice. She had put on makeup, and her clothes were mismatched but colorful. After a while, she said, "I don't make you feel uncomfortable, but I need a fix." "I'm okay," I said. She asked me, "It's not going to make you want to do drugs again, because I don't want to do that." What a heart and soul. Isn't that beautiful? I said, "I'm really good, but do you mind if I take some pictures of you?" "Sure, that's okay," she said. She climbed over the fence and sat next to me. She pulled out the drugs and cooked them up, the same ritual I knew by heart. She put the needle in her arm, she registered the blood into the needle, and she shot up. I photographed her as she closed her eyes and she laid back. She looked absolutely at peace. I remember that moment well. Every demon I had would relax and everything was golden. Well, except that you're a heroin addict and you're probably going to die. I sat with her a while longer before I had to go to the gig. I always carry $5, $10, and $20 bills around in my pockets to give people who need some help after I finish photographing them. I gave Roseanne $40. I asked her if that was enough, and she said that it was more than kind and unbelievable. Thank you, she said. I thanked her back. I said goodbye and turned to leave. As I walked away, I heard her voice again. Hey, Nikki? I turned around. You dropped your money, she said. I looked, and she gestured to where maybe $100 had fallen from my pocket onto the sidewalk. I looked at the money, and I looked at her. Why would you tell me that? I asked her. I was about to get in my car and leave. And she said, because it doesn't belong to me. I tried to give her the money. She said, no. I tried again, and I told her, I really want you to have this. This time she took it. I got in my car, went back to my hotel, and thought, I wish more people were like Roseanne. Later, when I showed James Michael the photo I'd taken of her and told him the story, he said, it just sounds like that moment has given her relief in her life. That's where the lyric for 6 a.m. song Relief came from. In a little while, all the weight of the world feels like a light rain. Right before we walked on stage with Motley Crue, I always said to the other guys, have fun, because being in a rock and roll band really is a lot of fun, and if it wasn't, why would you do it? When Motley walked off stage for the very last time, New Year's Eve, 2015, at the end of our third Staples Center show, I didn't feel sad. I felt proud that the band had been fantastic, the greatest ride of my life, and now it was over. I have nothing but great memories of Tommy, Vince, and Mick. We ruled the world together and always will in my heart. I will love the crew forever. I mean, how could I not? Okay, so what's next? I've always loved theater. Hell, I wrote an album called Theater of Pain. Even when Motley Crue was playing in clubs, I wanted the audience to feel like they were seeing more than just a rock show. One of my biggest criticisms of new rock bands today is that there is a loss of the theatrical presentation, and rock stars are becoming an endangered species. Apparently, it's cooler not to be cool. Where are the David Bowies, the Queens, the old Van Halens, and early Aerosmiths of today? Those artists combined all the great elements of mystery, classic storytelling, and superb musicianship. The look, the clothes, the stage design, and the artwork all wrapped up into a dangerous rock and roll package that delivered far more than just a few good songs. Everything was bigger than life and louder than hell. Fans used to get more than just a rock show, whether it was David Bowie and the Spiders from Mars or Pink Floyd taking you to the dark side of the moon. This spectacle is what drew me to music. I didn't sign up for rock and roll to wear a sweater, stand in the corner, and stare at my goddamn shoes. I wanted to wear Mad Max-looking clothes and war paint on my face and mix invent myths around punk rock meets British glam meets heavy fucking metal. And then take over the world one destroyed city at a time. No Keith Richards in his right mind would ever think that doing a YouTube video of a gerbil on a hamster wheel was the road to success, or buying Twitter or Instagram followers. It's what I still live for, and whether it was Motley Crue or 6 a.m., we always made a point to inject the theatrical into our music and show. I think that's a lot of the reason why we were successful. I sometimes wonder if I'm living on the same planet from when rock stars roamed the earth. You're either a T-Rex or you're a rabbit, and that's not a hard choice for me. So it was only natural we decided to turn the Heroin Diaries into a full-scale stage production. It seemed like such a natural progression of the material. Plus, we had already written the songs. Over the last few years, the stage production of The Heroin Diaries has come a long way. The writer, Todd Kriedler, and the director, David S. Bjornson, are highly respected in their fields. Todd wrote Holler If You Hear Me based on the lyrics of Tupac Shakur and also worked closely with the world-renowned playwright August Wilson for a number of years. David's directed productions by some of the greatest playwrights in modern history, including Edward Albee, Tony Kushner, and Arthur Miller. I feel very lucky to have met them and gotten the chance to work with them. It takes a great team to create great work and people who don't run on fear. This is the team. And because I'm always an inch away from the music business, we were very lucky to bring a producer named Michael Cole on board to help us finalize our vision. Michael is a longtime concert promoter of some of the biggest music acts in the world, the Rolling Stones and U2, just to name a few, the former chairman of Live Nation Entertainment, and the producer who brought us Broadway hits like The Producers, Hairspray, and Spider-Man. Boom. Lastly, we decided early on that we did not wish to take the traditional approach that most stage productions take, which is to open on Broadway, spend a lot of money up front, and see if the play's a hit. It reminded me too much of the pop music game, which I left a long, long time ago. When the producers, Alan Kovac and I, sat down and really thought about how to bring this to the people, we all thought, let's just bring it back to the beginning. We'll take this show to the fans as opposed to making them all come to New York to see it. And that was that. The production is set to tour the U.S. and Canada in early 2018. Each time I try to conquer a new art form, I have to remind myself that, if I work hard enough and just trust in the process and the people around me, I can successfully brave new artistic territory. As I've written before, I had no idea The Heroin Diaries would be as successful as it was. 6 a.m. was just supposed to be about 5 or 6 songs to accompany a book, but when people heard it, the band members and I knew we could take the band all the way. My radio show and photography came after these successes. One thing that the executives at iHeartRadio kept asking me was, do you really think you can do radio for more than a year? Because that's what we really need you to do. Apparently, other rock stars have tried building something like Sixth Sense before, but they just bailed after a few months when it got to be a lot of work. We're celebrating our 7th year on the air this month, and I can proudly say we are the biggest syndicated rock radio show in the world. Can I say it again? We are the biggest syndicated rock radio show in the world. As I head into the second half of 2017, I'm really looking forward to my first ever gallery show of my photography. My passion for photography is matched by my passion for all things artistic in life. Now, people are talking about my work in the same light as some of my idols like Ellen Von Unwerth and Diane Arbus. I'm sure that when I see opening night of The Heroin Diaries stage production, I'll have a similar reaction of, how the hell did I get here? This is one of the best feelings, knowing your hard work is paid off. What I've learned is this, work hard, harder than anybody else in the room. Listen to the people who have more experience than you and push yourself to be better at your craft. And be grateful. Honestly, if more people left their egos and their BS at the door, life would sure be a hell of a lot better. Are you ready to kick some ass? Because I am. So after this, let me tell you. Next is spending a long time at home sweet home. The other day, I'd fixed myself a cup of coffee in the kitchen. It took me a while to find the coffee cups. Oh, so this is where you keep them, I said to Courtney. She looked at me a little oddly. So what does it feel like to be in the house that you bought? She asked me. It was a good question, because I had hardly been here. I'd bought the house when I was on the road with Motley. Courtney and I walked through it once. I said I loved it. Let's get it. And then I left, back on the road again, where I've been for most of the last 35 years. I'm 58 now, and I love it. I like my age so much more than I did being 48, 38, or 28, especially 28. because that was the first time I died. I'm watching my kids grow up, and they're creative and talented, and I'm so proud of them. My oldest kids all moved out, and they're doing their own thing now. Sometimes I look at them and think, you're on your own path. Other times, I look and I see a little glimmer of that same spirit that I have. My goal is to raise them so they feel safe and they feel loved and to be unique. My son Gunnar is a musician and an artist. My daughter Storm is an artist and is exploring on what she wants to do. My son Decker is the analytical one. He's in college and kicking ass. And my youngest one, Frankie, she's in high school and is a cool little artist herself. And I want to have another baby. Courtney and I are trying now. Crazy, right? Well, sixes aren't conventional, but we are passionate. I hope I've been a good dad. I hope I am a good husband. I hope I am a good friend. And I hope I've left a deep, deep scar on the planet for the time that I'm here. I work hard and I love hard. Courtney and I have been together for 7 years. She's been there for me and supportive through the demise of Motley Crue and all those hard years when I wasn't home. It's not easy to be a rock and roll widow. I'm home now, and I'm going to be home for all my family. I don't know what's next musically, but I keep spitting out words like supergroup. Can you imagine? That would be the goddamn icing on the cake. Me and all my heroes in one band? Guess I better start thinking of a band name. When I was younger, I was carrying around a lot of false information. My hard drive was fragmented. It all got caught up with ego and money and drugs. I was young. I could do anything. I was invincible until it killed me. If I had died in the Franklin Plaza back in 1987, my epitaph would have just said, fuck you. That was pretty much what that guy had to say. Well, I'm glad I survived because my life is so much more beautiful now. As a kid and well into my time in Motley Crue, I used to love Johnny Thunders and Keith Richards for their lifestyles. I just wanted to be just like them, to be them. It took me a long time to see that you can be a cool cat without a fucking stupid drug habit. I mean, people like Keith or Joe Perry will always be cool guys and great musicians and artists. They are how I want to age. I want to be the guy who is up on stage still playing in my late 60s or even my 70s or even beyond. I want to embrace getting old. I don't want to die because of drugs or alcohol. I want to have fun the rest of my life and die of old age. Bring on the wrinkles and the snarl. When I think those things now or when I look back at the Heroin Diaries, I catch myself and I laugh because I realize that the young Nikki Six, he would hate my guts. He would spit in my fucking face and yell, what do you mean you've got a wife and kids and dogs and you eat healthy? Oh my God. What do you mean you don't drink or shoot heroin? You're not rock and roll at all. Truth be told, I'll outrock that little bastard any day of the week. And that means any of you newcomers too. And that's a challenge. Here's to the next chapter. Nikki Six, May 2017.